Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello, I'm Ollie Dugmore, and welcome to Unfiltered. My guest today used to be a footballer. A world-class striker, he won the Golden Boot at the 1986 World Cup, 80 caps for England. Today, he is the longest-serving and most outspoken Match of the Day presenter, the BBC's best paid presenter, and perhaps a bigger player in the media than he was on the pitch. He says, I was born to be in the box. I learnt how to be on the box, and I'll end up in a box. Gary Lineker, how's tricks?
That is great that you start with my funeral.
Yeah, a cheery place yeah. to start things off. How are you otherwise? You okay?
Yes, all good, thank you. Yes.
Good, I'm glad to hear it. We're talking on a Monday. Obviously, Match of the Day airs on the Saturday, so a day off today, chilling out. What's your sort of routine like midweek?
Well, it varies, to be honest. It's kind of unpredictable. Some weeks I'm really busy doing a variety of things. Other weeks I'll have fairly free. Mm-hmm. I'm tempted to say I go on mini retirements occasionally.
but I
prefer holidays.
Yeah. What was the other thing you said about something about sleeping or a mini death? I don't know. Yeah, an interesting one from Gary Neville. Yeah. I mean, it's been 5 years since you last sat in the unfiltered chair.
Opposite. Is it 5 years?
It has been five years. Yeah. And James O'Brien's got significantly younger as well. Mm. He said, if there's one thing Gary Lineker is not going to do, it's just stick to football. Mm-hmm. Since then, you've continued to live up to that reputation. You just won an Amnesty Award for speaking up for refugees. Did you ever envision that speaking about politics, humanitarian issues would always be something you'd end up doing, or is it something you've just kind of found yourself in?
Well, I don't think anyone in any field just sticks to their vocation. Mm. You don't, you know, just because you carve a career in football or journalism or whatever it may be, you don't just stick to that subject. And from my experience of this critique, which I have a lot of, it's generally from they're absolutely happy with you saying anything that you want until they disagree with it. Mm-hmm. And then they say, why don't you just stick to football? So I've never really taken that seriously. Yeah. And I don't, does a plumber just stick to plumbing?
No,
I don't think so.
I also think when people say, I'll keep politics out of sport, it's sort of an ahistorical reading of sport, particularly football in Britain, right?
They're intrinsically linked anyway. Yeah. And politics sneaks into everything.
Of course it does.
So you can't really avoid politics, whether you're in football or any other walk of life, I think.
Absolutely. As with all of our guests on Unfiltered, this is a conversation about how the events of your life made you who you are. So I think it makes sense to begin at the beginning. Were you encouraged to speak your mind as a child? Were you in your house? Was it a place where you could have ideas and talk about issues?
I was incredibly shy as a child.
Really?
I'm still in certain areas, large groups of people, things like that. I'm always a little bit small talk. I'm not very comfortable at that. I was very quiet. As a child, just played sport, really. In those days, I did want to stick to football. but I also had to go to school occasionally, which I didn't really enjoy very much. And I was pretty shy, very tiny. Like I was kind of the nerdy-looking kid with the sticky-out ears and the goofy teeth. And if I hadn't been good at good at sport, I probably would have been bullied.
So you played sport at school, obviously. You loved cricket as well as football, right?
Yeah.
How were you? Let's talk about the side you probably don't want to talk about as much, the academics. Were you?
No, I was all right. But just didn't enjoy it, and didn't like working at home, homework, stuff like that.
Yeah.
And I was so kind of devoted and ambitious to be a sports person that's the only thing I wanted to do. I didn't want to go and sit in a classroom doing physics and various other subjects. I like most people, I enjoyed the subjects I was good at. I still to this day think that education gets it kind of wrong. I don't think we try and find out what children are good at and then focus on that. No, we have to do maths. Even if you're really, really useless, you're going to have to do it until you leave school. Now they want to do it till they're 18, don't they?
But
things like, I was all right at maths, so I was good at maths until letters got involved in maths and then the algebra thing.
It goes up a level.
Never really understood that, but numbers, I was really good at numbers and stuff. Mm-hmm. But and English I enjoyed, I was good at that. So I was all right academically. I could have done a lot better if I'd worked harder.
Interested in other things. I was going to ask perhaps maybe some performance, a bit of public speaking maybe, obviously with a view to your later career. I mean...
No, nothing like that then.
Really?
No,
too
no,
shy?
No. Oh yeah, way too shy.
What about writing?
I used to write match reports. I used to go and watch Leicester, obviously, with my dad and my granddad from the age of around seven. And a little bit older than that, when I was probably in my teens, I used to write match reports, and I always thought that if I didn't make it as a footballer, then I'd want to be a sports journalist.
Did they get published, or is there just sort of a large filing cabinet?
No, I have no idea where they are. In fact, it's really annoying, really, because we had a flood in the house, in the loft. I can't remember why, but we lost all the pictures, all the cuttings of everything from like childhood. So when people say, "Oh, you got any pictures of you as a kid?" There's like one from the Leicester Mercury, the local newspaper that I find, and that's about all. That's it.
Rough, isn't it? Because
I wasn't a very good looking kid, so
maybe you're actually quite
not
pleased
a great looking
about
adult
that.
Either,
slightly abstract question, but I think it's a nice way to kind of get a picture of how you conceive your childhood. If we were to make a film about your life, what do you think the first scene would be? Where would it start?
Oh, I don't know. I think you'd start with the Golden Boot in 1986.
Yeah, oh yeah, sorry. Okay.
Forget everything else before that. That's a really good question. I don't know. When I read autobiographies, I tend to get really bored about the childhood bit and then skip forward. Yeah. So maybe I won't even bother with it.
You won't bother. Hint to me? Should I stop talking about this?
But you could do a clip of me scoring like hundreds of goals. I mean, I scored so many goals when I was a kid. I mean, it's a lot easier, funnily enough, when you're playing against other school kids than it is when you're an adult. But I think I got 160 something in one season.
Wow.
So that would have been a good
That would be a good place to start.
Maybe. Yeah, forget the school bit.
And in between playing at school and obviously your academics, you worked with your dad as well in Leicester on that fruit and veg stall.
Occasionally.
Every now and then. Yeah. Tell me about your dad. Was he someone you looked up to as a role model for you?
Yeah, very much so. He was a character, my dad. Very well known in Leicester through the market stall. I mean, the market was like three generations of my family. My dad, it stopped with me and my brother, although my brother did do it for a while and then went into other things. But he was really hardworking, lived life to the full, used to smoke those non-tipped, like Churchill kind of cigarettes, like 60, 80 a day, succumbed to lung cancer in the end, unsurprisingly. But he worked hard, played hard, drank hard, played cards. We used to have a card school at my house pretty much every Sunday evening, which would carry on well into Monday, often to Tuesday morning, if it was a holiday.
Uh-huh.
And people like Engelbert Humperdinck would come and play on a regular basis. So I know it's bizarre, but he was Engel, known to us as Engel. And do you know what? When you think, is my memory playing tricks on me? And did that actually really happen? Did Engelbert Humperdinck come to my house every week? And then when Leicester won the cup, the BBC did a thing with him because he's a Leicester fan. And he said, I used to go to his house to play cards. And I thought, yes.
It's true.
I didn't imagine it. I didn't make it up.
So
it was hard. On his days off, he would go fishing. And I'd go fishing with him sometimes. Mm. But yeah, I love my dad. He was, you know, old school, quite stoic. And my parents split when I was about 20, 21. But I stayed close to them, even though they were apart. But he didn't. He wasn't one of those that talked about his emotions too much. And until he got older, until he knew he was dying, and it changed. And I used to go up to Leicester, up and down. And then, for the first time in our lives, we had kind of long and meaningful conversations. Wow. Even about football. And he always obviously believed in me. But you know, I said to him, "How did you know?" Did you ever think that I had a chance? Because I never really, I kind of wanted it, but I always thought I won't make it. But And he went, oh no, I always knew. And I said to him, well you could have told me. and then he got gradually worse and more ill. Didn't have long left. And I think the last Compass Mentis conversation we had, I was just about to leave and he went, son, I love you. And I'd never heard him say that. And I just went, I love you too. And I ran out, got in the lift, and I went one floor down. About seven nurses got in, and it was like, oh, poor him,
crying. Yeah.
My eyes out. But he was a good man. My dad was a hardworking, good man and fun. Big Bad Bacardi Barry, he was nicknamed at one point.
Big Bacardi Barry.
By my sons, they named him that.
That's a good nickname.
Yeah, loved his rum.
It must be difficult. Obviously, to hear that from him from the first time at that point.
It wasn't difficult. It was wonderful.
Really?
Yeah. I knew he loved me, but you know, that generation don't share their feelings as much as perhaps we do now.
So has your approach to fatherhood differed in that you're perhaps a bit more forthcoming with your emotions?
Yeah,
definitely. Your dad was.
Yeah, much more, I think. And I think that's just moved that way, isn't it? Uh-huh. Anyway, yeah.
But obviously, as a father, you probably learned a lot from him, right? And you've tried to, be as positive a role model for your boys as he was for you.
Well, it's difficult being a father, isn't it? Because there's no real training for it. You're just kind of thrown in at the deep end. Here you go. It's obviously harder for a mother, but being, you know, being a father, and even with my boys, who are obviously, you know, they're entitled. They're fairly secure. They're going to be okay. Whatever happens, hopefully. But even then, it's that balance, isn't it, between, you know, making sure that they're secure but not spoil. And it's a very difficult balance to find. What's right? What's wrong? What do you give them? What do you make them go for themselves? And trying to find that, I've found, you know, difficult at times, but I've kind of worked out the way I think is fair. But you want them to have drive as well. So it's tough for any parent, that, I think. I mean, it's a lot better problem to have than if you're really struggling in life, but nevertheless.
There must be a degree of pressure as well, you know, when your father is so successful, both, you know, as a footballer and also in the media. I think about myself in that position, you know, obviously having something to look up to, but also it would manifest itself as pressure to, you know, to perform and feel like perhaps that you haven't fulfilled your potential when you know that your dad had it and as much as you do.
Yeah. I tell them I'm way better than them at football and stuff like that.
Just keep them in their place.
No, you're absolutely right. I suppose. I don't think it's something. I think they're, you know, quite proud of it as well. The fact that I've, you know, done okay in life. But I don't think any of them have got like that competitive need to do better than me in that, whatever their field is. But at the same time, I do genuinely feel they want to please me and want to do well, not just for them, but for me and their mother as well, of course. Mm. So, it's not a daily conversation where you, I mean, we're all competitive, but it's not in that way, but you're absolutely right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Let's take it back to sort of your early life. You joined Leicester City as an apprentice. Could you tell me a little bit more about that?
We were all kind of delegated jobs. So, and it doesn't happen now. So it's changed. Now they just pay them a lot of money at 16. In those days, I was on 20 quid a week. No, I'll tell a lie. I was on £16 a week. And I had a separate envelope with a fiver in that I had to give to my mum because I was a local boy, and whereas the kids that come in got the food and all that from the digs that they stayed in. So, but my mum always gave it me back. She never let me have the fiver. So, so being an apprentice was, it was interesting. You were delegated jobs. My job was, in the first season, was to clean up the first team dressing room. In those days, they would train. And well, we used to train at a place called Beaver Drive, which was a couple of miles away. But we would change in the at Filbert Street, or the first team certainly did. And I had the job of keeping the dressing room clean, providing their kits. I mean, it's not like now. Players get like five sets of kits a week to training. They get a new set every day. In those days, you had to make it last a week. So they used to have these kind of wrought iron hangers. And on a Monday, when they just chuck their stuff out, and it was always numbered, and you had to sort it out and go in and then put it on these hangers, everyone's kit on a different hanger. And then you put it in the drying room overnight. Now, you can imagine by Thursday and Friday, it's the socks basically walked on their own. Ugh. And it was this, and the slips, or pants, as you would call them now, were disgusting.
I bet.
And it was kind of, I'd never forget that stench of that that drying room.
Smelling it now.
When I'd go in, smelling the roses. so this it was grim.
It's pretty far removed from the current academy experience, what you've just described there, isn't it? And I'm not to, you know, belittle what those lads go through, because it is hard. It's still hard. Obviously it is. But it's different.
It is.
And it's more of a machine. And sometimes the sort of the younger players that go through that process and get spat out, don't end up with a contract, could be a very difficult...
It's tough. And obviously that is the vast majority.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, one of my boys was at Chelsea's academy for a couple of years, Tobias. And I used to look around. I used to go and watch him. Mm-hmm. And there were hundreds of kids across it, different age groups. And I used to look around and I think, if one or two of them make it, and they're the ones that have been cherry-picked from right around London and stuff like that. And you know how difficult it is, really difficult.
When you went professional, you obviously had a brilliant and extensive career, which we don't need to retread because most people know it.
if but, they're old enough.
Yeah, well. how did you stay grounded? I mean, you know, take your pick, Barcelona, Everton, Leicester, Spurs. What kept you...
I think what really helped me was that I wasn't a childhood sensation. So I wasn't like Michael Owen, who's brilliant at 16, or Wayne Rooney, the same, or you know, Jude Bellingham now. There's so many players like that. Phil Foden, and there's lots of them. I think what helped me was the fact that mine was a gradual rise. I was a late developer. In all sorts of ways. I didn't reach puberty till I was 17. Used to hide in the showers and stuff. It was quite embarrassing. and so I was a kind of slow developer. I got into the first team on a regular basis when I was around 20, 21. And then from 21, 22 onwards, I started scoring a lot of goals in the first team. Because the first 30-odd games I played on the right wing, because I think they saw something, but they...
Just wanted to get you in the team.
They couldn't get me in my position, but yeah, exactly. So it was kind of the slow development, and I think that helped me. I mean, every level I reached surprised me. I just, you know, I kept thinking this will find me out. But whatever level it was, I just managed to keep scoring goals, even with England. So much I remember playing against Spain, and I scored the fourth goal and all four goals in that game away from home in the Bernabeu. Running back to halfway line, Brian Robson's with me, and I'm going, God, Robbo, why am I so lucky? And he went, oh, fuck off.
Yep, sounds about right. Yeah. I mean, so the summer you went to Barcelona, Golden Boot, then you agree you're going to go, you get married,
yep,
honeymoon, yep. Off to Barcelona.
Whatever you do, Ollie, don't get married.
Gary, I hate to break it to you. Yeah, yesterday.
I know, that's what I say. Congratulations.
It's too late, mate.
Well done, Ollie.
Cheers, I appreciate it. I appreciate it. But yeah, tell me about that summer. That must have been crazy.
It was mad. I'll go back to my dad as well. He was the only person on earth who backed me to be top scorer. I think he got 16 to 1, I think he got or something, which was not a very generous price. But, but he won a few quid then. So it was a mad summer. So I finished this amazing season at Everton. Best team I ever played in, best club side I ever played in. But we didn't win anything. We should have. We should have won the double. We ended up missing out on both just to Liverpool. So it was your worst nightmare. Mm. And then, so from that disappointment of missing out in the end, to go to the World Cup and finish top scorer. And then it was funny because during the, it was just before the World Cup, though, that Everton first told me about some interest from Barcelona and they think they might accept a price. And then the World Cup, I can't remember exactly why, it went quiet anyway. And then I went to the World Cup and then I had a conversation with my agent before I went about the move. And I went, let's not discuss any transfers until the World Cup's over. I don't want anything to cloud my mind.
Yeah.
And he said, okay, that's fine. Then we went to Mexico and the first two games didn't go very well. Didn't score. And we'd heard nothing. Obviously, there were no stories then. And then I scored a hat-trick and then I got another couple against Paraguay. And all of a sudden, I'm top scorer in the World Cup. And in those days, obviously, 1986, we didn't have mobile phones or anything. So, in fact, it's so different to how it is now. We were allowed, I think, one phone call a week from the... you kind of had to make it from the hotel reception in Mexico. And we were all sitting having dinner and someone came in and said, there's a phone call for Mr. Lineker. And I went, crikey, what's that? What? So it's my agent. And it was John, who's still my agent today. He's been my agent for 45 years. And he said, I know you said not to disturb you. He said, and I've kind of wrestled with this. He said, but I think I have to, under the circumstances of what they've said. He said, Barcelona have been in touch and they want to sign you and they've agreed with Everton, but they need a yes now. Otherwise, they're not going to sign you. And I said, if they want to sign me now, they'll want to sign me at the end of the World Cup. So call their bluff, because I cannot do that now.
Yeah.
I cannot get involved in that now.
Uh-huh.
No, we're about to play in the quarterfinal of the World Cup. So then that's how the Barcelona thing. So then I come home. We were always due to get married as well. So did the deal in the Connaught Hotel. So it was all really sneaky. So we had Terry Venables, who was then manager of Barcelona. We had Howard Kendall, who was then manager of Everton. We had the chairman of Everton. We had the vice president, Juan Gaspar, who came over from Barcelona, and the two or three other people. And we had the meetings, and we got the deal done in an upstairs suite. And I'd been kind of hidden behind back doors and all this kind of stuff, so the press wouldn't know. And I spoke to the president, who didn't speak a word of English, on the phone, which was really bizarre because I didn't speak a word of Spanish at that point. And then we signed the deal and it was all right. And then they said, right, dinner. And they'd got dinner in the middle of the restaurant with everybody there. And it's a bit kind of baffling. So we did the deal. Then I got married. Then I went on honeymoon. And then instantly I was straight into training at Barcelona.
And you're fluent in Spanish now?
I get rusty now and I search for words sometimes. But yes, I'm fluent. And I was very, I used to think in it in my last year there.
Did you dream in it?
Sometimes, yeah. Yeah, that's, I did do when I was in the last, probably the last year, six yeah. months, yeah.
Am I right in understanding you commentated a little bit in Spanish?
I did co-commentary.
Co-commentary.
Yeah, I did a bit co-commentary. In Spanish, yeah, yeah.
Did you want to do that? Did the club put you forward for it?
No, that came separately. It was just, yeah. Even in those days, I was always looking and going back to writing match reports, if you like. I was always interested in the journalistic side. My nickname with England, but given, I think Gazza and Chris Waddle used to call me Junior Des because I was going
already
prematurely grey, you see. But
sure.
Yeah, because I used to sit with the journalists. I used to sit with the radio people watching how they did their intros and stuff like that. Yeah.
Really?
Because I kind of knew what I...
You knew what you wanted to do afterwards.
I certainly knew I wanted to go into television, and then latterly I started to think, I want to present because no one does that in football. Bob Wilson did it and did it well. But there'd not been a player who played right at the top like I had that had gone into it, whereas cricket had Gower.
Mm.
Tennis had Sue Barker, and I used to think if I could crack the presenting side, then that might give me some kind of longevity.
Mm-hmm.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for, but you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
You've done the presenting side of things with the BBC. You also have, so that's sort of the old media side of things, if you like. You've got the new media side of things as well with Goalhanger Productions.
Yeah, which is
podcast. Well, brilliant. Podcast, TV production as well. So you kind of sit across both old and new. Yeah. Was that a strategic choice by you? Are you sort of thinking...
Well, it came about originally. I mean, I've made lots of documentaries over the years for BBC, which I didn't get anything extra for, but it was... And they were quite satisfying. But there's a guy called Tony Pastore. I used to be a producer at BBC, and then he was kind of head at football at ITV. And then he went on his own with a production company. And then we bumped into each other, and he said, oh, we used to chat about making programmes. He said, what do you fancy going in with a production company and we'll, you know, I'll start again, we'll 50-50 and we'll go from there. And I went, I'd love to do that. It'd be really interesting. So that was, probably 9-10 years ago now, probably. Mm. And then from that, we did lots of films and it's a nice little business and we have a lot of fun with it. And then I did a podcast with Danny Baker, Behind Closed Doors, which was a lot of fun, really popular, and it did quite well, and we thought there might be something in this podcast thing. So and then we diverted away from sport. We had one called We Have Ways Making You Talk with Alan Murray and James Holland, which is very popular. It's niche, obviously. It's all about Second World War and hundreds of episodes. And then we Rest Is History, and then the rest is and they've become, well, they're giants. Yeah. I mean, they really are. I mean, and the guys are great, and it's become a lot of fun. It's mm-hmm. really, really good. Something different.
Oh, I'm trying to understand the sort of the new media, old media angle here. Mm. So live TV, live sport on TV is probably one of the only times that a younger audience these days tunes into their television.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And you're probably quite uniquely positioned, to be honest with you, in terms of TV broadcasting, to be accessing that audience, because the rest of the time it's non-linear, right? It's iPlayer, Netflix.
Yeah, I mean, and a lot of the football now and live stuff is going on iPlayer. Mm. I mean, the iPlayer numbers for the weekend when we did the FA Cup final were really about 3 million on iPlayer.
Really?
Watching it live on iPlayer. Okay. So, and obviously some of them would be watching it later. Yeah. So it's an interesting the way it shifted. So, I mean, it means TV audiences were always judged on people who, you know, the buttons on the back of people's TV sets and all that sort of stuff. But now I think it's easier probably to get more accurate data from the iPlayer and things like that. So it has shifted. And I was talking the other day, when was the last time you used, certainly as a young person, when was the last time you actually went, right, let's see what's on telly? And you go, scroll down, BBC One, BBC Two, ITV, Channel Four, but just don't do that anymore, do you? You pick and choose. I think, you know, certainly for terrestrial TV, the big moments now are definitely sport. Mm. Definitely, they get the biggest numbers by a mile. Reality TV shows that, you know, youngsters will watch as well. Maybe big news events.
Yep.
And it's quite interesting the way it's changed. And so you've got to kind of try and shift with it a little bit.
I always thought I was a bit of a freak for sort of re-watching or, you know, revisiting a sporting match that already happened and you already knew the score, that I'd want to go and just see how the game went. Mm. During the World Cup, I mean, we don't have to go too far in sort of audience habits and stuff, but was it a similar story? Was a lot of iPlayer viewing? Rather
really than, was, yeah. Really? I think that's the first time we've gone, gosh, this is a real shift.
Yeah.
Because don't forget, you know, when I perhaps played in the World Cup, and I think Italia 90 was probably the first time that, you know, you saw no cars on the streets and stuff. People had to get home to watch it.
Yeah.
Whereas you don't now. You can watch it on your phone, even on your iPad or whatever, wherever you are, even when you're at work. So It's definitely changed.
How much of what you're doing then, looking at the podcasting space, is sort of not a bet, but a decision to think audiences are changing, I still want to be a part of this media landscape, whether it's as a business owner, whether it's as a presenter, and that's where I think it's going. Is that kind of...
Well, particularly in the production side of things, because what we've got like kind of two wings to our business. And on the production side, in terms of TV shows, you have an idea. Then you have to try and pitch it and get it commissioned. So you go around and then you've got to kind of conjure up a budget from somewhere and then try and make it. In a podcast, you just go,
fuck it.
We'll just do it. Exactly.
Yeah.
We'll just do it. And there's no real, you know, to make it, the costs are not, you know, huge. You need good people. It's all about people. So it's very different. You know, thankfully we've got some of the top few.
It's just your podcast up there, isn't it? I think.
Not just ours. There are others that don't warrant a mention.
We won't mention them.
But it's fine. I'm sure your one is right up there.
We're doing okay.
We're not quite
up there yet, Gary.
Why do you think I'm on it?
But that's the point, right? Particularly with The Rest Is Politics, you know, that is Alistair and Rory, loads of people listening, and that's a lot of influence within British society.
It's good, and they're good, we talk about
I don't want to compare you to Rupert Murdoch because that's unfair, but you know, at the end of the day,
I look the same.
that's rough. But it's a lot of influence, you know. If we're talking hundreds of thousands of people listening to these two people talking about politics, and that's a lot of influence. I know obviously you're not on the show, or you did a leading interview with them, didn't you? But you know, it's them presenting it, but still you're kind of, you're taking a position really within the British political landscape, you know, in the same way when you tweet about issues that...
It wasn't necessarily our plan, but you're absolutely right in a way. I suppose I think we do influence things. They do anyway,
definitely.
Those two. And I think we've been through a period of this tribal kind of diverse thing. You've got, you know, extremes on both sides shouting loud and stuff. And I think if we've done something, and I hope it's important, I think, and Rory and Alistair, is that this whole thing about agreeing disagreeably and all that kind of thing, but he's actually, I think they're appealing to what I think most of us are. I think most of us are kind of somewhere in the middle, either to the right or to the left. And it's fine. And but I think what we've had is it's the ones that shout the loudest, we notice the most. So we think anyone on the right is like extreme right and hates everybody on the left, and everybody extreme left hates everybody on the other side. So I think if we do one thing, I hope we do, it wasn't the plan at all, is to actually bring some decency back, stop the tribal nonsense, and I think that's important. And the boys are great, and I think the important thing with podcasts is the chemistry between the two, and it's the same with The Rest Is History boys.
Yep.
Tom Holland and Dominic Sandbrook, who are so excellent, and I think people have a connection with the people, and if we bring things back to the centre and some kind of good, you know, niceness, niceness rather than hatred and abuse would be a good, really good thing.
Yeah. So I think, okay, there's a lot I want to talk about here. So I totally agree with you, especially at the format where it's two people having a conversation. There's so much more room for nuance. It's a lot more subtle. You do, of course, have a very, very popular Twitter account. And I wonder whether there's a difference between...
Popular to some.
Less popular to others. Yeah, fair enough. But, you know, there's less room for nuance on Twitter, isn't there?
And I guess I'm a bit worried about Twitter now. It's gone kind of...
Go on.
It's drifted lately. I don't know why. I think what's happened now, there was a time when I was on... And I'm talking about personal here, not generally on Twitter and whether it's good or bad. For many, it might be good. But before Musk, before the whole blue tick paying thing, which I did pay for. I paid it for ages ago because you get edit button, which is really useful. it only works for 30 minutes, but I used to hate it when I make like a spelling mistake or something or something like that. So I actually bought it, and then it became shameful to have bought one. But the problem now is, I don't know about you, but it used to get two columns, didn't you, that you could read, the one with everybody on it, which was like a cesspit, and ruined by nasty people, ruining it for all good people.
Yeah.
And then you get a thing which I read, which was other blue tick people and people that I followed. Whereas now that that blue tick thing, everyone's got one. And so I can't even look at that now.
You can't engage with people.
You will have that small percentage of people that absolute troll you and hate you. And it's kind of awash with that. And it ruins it for all the nice people and the good people, because it's nice to engage with people. But if, you know, but they say they spoil it for everyone. And I think, and Twitter's gone down that now. And it's kind of, it's probably for the best, maybe for a reason, but I've backed off a little bit. Not for political reasons or anything like that, but just because it's just become not as pleasant a place as it. I mean, it's never been wholly pleasant, but I think it's worse.
But basically, there's a lack of meaningful discourse in a way that before you'd be able to have conversations with people. You could tweet something, go back.
Which I don't do now.
You can't do
it now. No, not really.
Do you think that was kind of reflected in the whole, we don't need to retread it, but the whole palaver recently with the BBC? Do you think there was a bit of lost meaning in what you were saying and
didn't have
the ability to go back and chat to people about it?
And that was probably a prime example of it, where I wouldn't have seen that reply that I got under the old Twitter. So I wouldn't have been kind of, I wasn't angered, but I was just, you know, I did a riposte that I wish I hadn't done, only because of the furore that followed. I don't take a word back what I say. I think I was factually correct, and that, and which is, you know, why I stood my ground. I don't think it was like a necessarily opinion thing. I think it's factual. So, but yes, I probably wouldn't have seen that otherwise, and life would have been a bit calmer. It was a surreal few days. I kept thinking, this is really about not very much at all. But anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I remember it was massive. I mean, you had reporters camped outside your house, right?
6 days.
You got
6 days, morn till night.
Doorstepped, walking Filbert, I think.
I did walk in Filbert. I remember on the Friday, I had when it really kind of, the shit hit the fan, and as it, so to speak. I remember thinking, I was going to have lunch in town with a couple of friends. And I thought, great, I'm going to get, I don't want them all following me to the restaurant. But I always get the train anyway, but I'm thinking, oh, they'll come and I'll be on the bloody train now. Embarrassing, will that be? So it's a kind of about a 6 minute walk to the station from mine. And I always get the train in, so as I did today. And I normally leave about 7 or 8 minutes before the train's due, check it out. So on this occasion, I thought, right, I'll leave it 4 minutes before the train go and run. So I came out the door and it was like, and they all over, they're coming out with my, do you want to say anything? Really sorry, guys. I'm really late for my train. I've got to run. So I go running right. Wow. It was like, like a scene from Benny Hill.
Yeah.
It was like, duh, 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 duh. And they're all chasing me. They're chasing me with microphones and cameras.
And you used to do a pretty fast 100 metre, I think, 10.5 seconds.
I did, but I'm fairly ancient now. So anyway, so I'm running around, I'm moving away from them, and this guy, he's obviously the reporter who's been given the microphone, the big grey furry thing. So he's chasing me with it. Gary said, he said, you're too fast for us. I said, you're half my age. Man, sort yourself out.
Fucking catch up, pal.
So, and eventually I'm running and running and running, and I get to the station. I've seen them off. They've given up. And I remember I got on the platform. I was like, I was going to keel over. I was sweating buckets on the train. But I made my lunch, and they didn't disrupt it.
Yeah. Good to hear. Let's go back to what we were talking about. Finding that common ground and having nice, calm conversations. That need for discourse.
Yeah.
Do you think that's something unique to the podcast? That's why it's been so popular. Do you think there's something broader in sort of the population that people want to be able to have these conversations without, let's say, the tribalism you typically associate with Twitter?
I think that's definitely one of the things. I think that is that, you know, the good-natured aspect to it. But I think it's also incredibly informative. I mean, these two guys have been around everybody between them. I mean, Alistair obviously was, you know, Blair's comms for 12 years. He's a big personality. He's met everybody in politics. Rory's kind of been there. He ran to be prime minister, ran to lead the Tory party, I should say.
Yep.
Ran to be Lord Mayor. He's met everyone. He's been close up with Boris Johnson and Gove and all these characters that we've had to endure over the last few years. And so, you know, they just know everybody. And I think it's a mixture of, I mean, I I sometimes feel, well, I'm fairly thick anyway, but I sometimes feel I mean, their knowledge of worldwide events and politics is, but it is their field. Mm. So you expect them to be. I mean, if I had a similar conversation about football, then I do on many occasions. But I think it's their knowledge, the people they know, their contacts, and the way they get on together, even though obviously there are differences, but not that many differences, because it's going back to that thing. Rory's a little bit to the right of the centre, and Alistair's definitely to the left of the centre. So, if you'd have told me that, it's only been going just over, it's about 15 months now, but if you'd have told me 16 months ago that this is a podcast that will be super successful, that would sell out big venues like the Albert Hall in 20 minutes for 5,000 people watching two middle-aged white blokes talk about politics.
Two centrist
dads. I said, you're completely mad.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's been a surprise.
One thing they do agree on, obviously, is Boris Johnson. And unfortunately, we lost him this weekend. He stood down as an MP. Poor one out.
Sad day.
I imagine they were probably, your group chat with them probably was quite spicy. Really?
Not spicy. It was, we need an emergency pod.
Oh, right. Fine.
Where are you? Oh, Rory's just flying into Amman. Yeah. Oh, okay. We'll have to wait to half an hour. And then he's sprinting back to his house. So it was more about trying to organise that than. I don't get involved in spicy chat on group chats.
No, not at all, obviously. will you miss our dearly departed former Prime Minister?
I sense he won't go far. I sense he will remain within us for quite some time.
I think so.
He'll be back some way, shape or form.
Let's move on then and talk a little bit more about the BBC, because obviously we were just talking about it, right? This big furore around it. I don't want us to go into that, but to talk about perhaps changes that could happen at the BBC so that perhaps that situation doesn't happen again. Do you think the political involvement that perhaps Boris Johnson was involved in with selecting, let's say, Richard Sharpe, etc., that whole thing, do you think that needs to go? That should change?
I think that the fact that the government of the day, now whether that's Labour or Conservative or any other party that may emerge, is by the by. It doesn't seem right if you're so kind of driven by trying to find impartiality, then you've got to start from the top. So yes, I agree. I've said that publicly many times, that I don't think that's right, and that's nothing against Richard Sharpe. I don't know him. I've met him briefly for a few seconds. So I think that's important, but it's very difficult, and it's very difficult for the BBC, because the impartiality thing is so tough to get right, because if they're on the right, they are absolutely convinced the BBC has a left-wing bias. The people on the left are absolutely convinced that the BBC has a right-wing bias. So you're constantly fighting that. So it is very difficult. My personal view is that it was okay as it was, with, you know, proper staffers, people on news and current affairs, and the rest of us have to try and be sensible without being, you know, having these strict guidelines that were brought in after I'd signed my contract. So the goalposts were shifted halfway through, that it suddenly became applicable to everyone. And I tried my best. I never tell anyone who I vote for. I'm never going to tell anyone what to do.
I noticed you wouldn't be drawn on that Boris Johnson question I just asked you as well. You can tell.
Well, there you go. You see, I do my very best at all times.
What do you see as the role, though, for the BBC? Let's say a broader conversation about England, Britain, kind of.
I think the BBC needs to be more proud of itself.
Yeah.
And needs to shout out a little bit more about how good it is. And it is, you know, in difficult times.
Yeah.
In difficult times, it's still an incredible institution. It's got, you know, it's got its faults, and it's a strange place in many ways, and it's very difficult sometimes. You know, it's become more difficult to work for. You know, we get our salaries published now, which I'm one of those that has been dead open about my salaries with, you know, so it's, you know, I don't do any tricky means to try and pay less tax or anything like that. So, you know,
good to know.
So, you know, I don't have it going via a production company. So I'm at the top of it, and I'm pretty sure there'll be one or two people that earn more. But so I get battered every July, and it's now June, and it's coming.
Oh,
again.
We're gearing up for it.
It's coming again.
Something to look forward to.
it's I'm so used to it now. It's the same. But but I think what we should do is remind, you know, people of how good we do sport, how good we do news, of how good we do drama, of how good do we do so many different things, and how good value it is, the license fee. You know, it's like the price of a cup of coffee a week. And I think there's a lot of good in there. And I think sometimes, rather than be defensive all the time, it's actually go out on the attack and sell it for what it is. It's like, it's a fantastic product.
Let's talk. Well, can we delve a bit more into the phrase you use there, difficult times? Are you talking in general? Are you talking about something specific right now in Britain? What did you mean by that?
Well, I think it's probably the shift with social media.
Right.
That perhaps there's so many more opinions are heard, and particularly those that, you know, are on either side, either wherever it is. It goes back to that point about people that, you know, the most extreme shout the loudest. So I think the BBC has to try and come to terms with that. And I think that's, you know, it's one of the downsides of social media. I think there's a lot of upsides, but I think, you know, you could say it gives lots of people, ordinary people, a voice. So you could say it's a thing of good, but I think it does make it more difficult for a kind of national broadcaster.
I guess on the one hand, you can say positive things or make statements about climate change or refugees, and then on the other hand, it might be Richard Madeley shouting at you in an interview going viral, and this kind of
that was very odd.
It was
a bit Partridge, wasn't it?
A little bit. Was that at the time? No, that was more recently, wasn't it, that happened?
Yeah, it was just a couple of weeks ago, 3 weeks ago.
Weird. Can we talk a little bit about the World Cup, if that's all right?
Absolutely. Football.
We'll stick to football. We've done far too much politics now. We have to get back to football. How was it working in Qatar? What were the conditions? I know there was a lot of talk beforehand about the politics
it was as I expected. Really, it was different, and there were pros and cons. You didn't quite get that atmosphere that you'd normally get at a World Cup, because there weren't as many visiting fans, particularly from Europe, although there was a different kind of fans were coming from different areas of the world. Like a lot of fans came from North Africa, which was good. You even had, you know, a lot of Asian supporters coming. So it was a different kind of atmosphere. Probably the fact that there was no alcohol around, but bar. So that probably calmed things down, which is not necessarily a bad thing either. So it felt very safe. It did feel a little bit different in the atmosphere sense, but at the same time, it was pretty well organised, although it was very controlling, you know, queues around things and stuff was different. But the real positive from a personal and selfish point of view was that normally when we go to a World Cup, we're parked up in some important place in that country's capital, like in Red Square, we were overlooking in Moscow, Table Mountain in South Africa, the beach in Rio, which was bearable. but we hardly got to see a game.
Yeah.
We'd watch it on the telly like everybody else. And we're trying to do the analysis and stuff off there. Whereas in Qatar, because it's so small, the furthest journey to any game was 40 minutes. So we did every single match in the stadium and watching the game, which is so much better for us. And that was a real plus. There are pluses and minuses, and some people had really good experiences there. And I know perhaps, you know, some found it more difficult than others, perhaps, you know, because of the kind of homophobia that is kind of coursing through their veins.
You felt the need as well at the beginning. I think it was literally the first broadcast, wasn't it? You guys did a piece about migrant rights, about LGBT rights. You focused on all of it, and I think that was fairly extraordinary, really, for sort of a World Cup broadcast. I mean, unless you could think of a previous example.
I think there was a reason, really, because I think that made this one different was not necessarily the human rights issues, because, you know, every World Cup that we do has issues in some ways. So, you know, we went to Moscow a few years after they'd already invaded before. Mm. We were in Rio, and there were massive demonstrations everywhere about the fact they shouldn't be spending fortunes on building stadiums when they've got social problems. In the safety in South Africa was a big thing, in talked about before. So there's always been kind of something. But I think what made this one different was the fact, the way they got the World Cup, that it was corrupt, and we know that. Their evidence is all there, and I was in the room when it was given to Qatar. And it wasn't about the fact that England didn't get it, because we weren't up for that World Cup anyway.
Yeah.
It was the one with Russia that we lost to. But it was just Qatar in the summer. It's 40, 50 degrees. You can't play football. Yeah. And it was like, I remember I felt like I needed a shower when I got out. It was that bad. But so it was more that. And then the other things within that, you know, the workers, the migrant workers, and the way they were treated and the lives that were lost, they were kind of just factual things. They were just factual things, like laid out on the list. But I think the fundamental thing was that why we did that as an opening, and it, you know, obviously this was decided by a lot of people, but we wanted to make it basically telling people the facts.
Yep.
And we got, you know, heavyweights involved, you know, from the BBC News department as well, to make sure that it was right. We should have done it in Russia, to be honest. In hindsight, probably after, you know, what they'd done. And now, you know, if it had been after Ukraine, which was, you know, they did it in 2014 first, but so yeah, we probably should have done it then. That's the one criticism I would gladly accept.
I don't want to go too far into the BBC's editorial processes, but just quickly, how much input do you personally have on a decision like that? You know, obviously you're the person reading
the words. So obviously I very much, strong part.
Okay. We've spoken a lot about father-son relationships and you being a role model, your father being a role model. I'd like to ask you, we're getting towards the end of the interview now, to sort of make a value judgment about whether you think you've been a good role model over the course of your life.
I've never set out to be a role model.
Yeah.
Regardless,
I think you probably are.
Well, I think we are, and footballers are, and they don't, you know, you don't ask for that. You go into football because you love playing football. You don't go into football for money. You don't go in football for to be a role model. You don't go into football to be famous. You go into football because you love playing football. And that was certainly the case with me. Obviously, you know, you branch out as a human being as you progress. I would like to think, I think it's inevitable that you do become a role model if you become a big football star. I've been really proud of the young footballers and the way they've used their platforms for good. I hope I've been a good role model. Some people that agree with my stance on things will think I'm a good role model. People who disagree with my stance on things will think I'm an awful role model.
Yeah.
It doesn't really matter what I think.
What's the final question then? What's the difference between the public Gary Lineker and the private Gary Lineker?
Not much.
What you see is what you get.
Yeah, I think what you see is what you get. Yeah, I think so. Yeah. And I think that's what happens if you've been in the public eye for a long time, particularly on television. You can kind of blag it for a while, who whatever you are, but in the end, your personality will come out.
People will find out.
People will find out. And I think whatever they found out, I think that's what they'll get when they, yeah.
Would you do it again? Go on TV and, you know, become the sort of media man.
I love my life. I enjoy fame. People are lovely. You know, you can, it's so easy to be distracted by the tiny percentage on Twitter. It really is. Where in the real world, it's not like that at all. I think I've had only two instances in my entire life where people have had a pop, verbal pop. One old lady elbowed me in my back. She was on her way to a Tommy Robinson rally.
Really?
Yes.
Okay, nice.
An old lady, she gave me, "Whoa, Lineker!" And something like, whoa, whoa.
Yeah.
And then I had another one where I was going shopping, my groceries, and some bloke shouted, out of the road. You hate Britain. You hate Britain, don't you? I'm going, no, I really love Britain. But anyway, so that they're the only two examples I can think of in my entire life.
And yet you open Twitter and it's...
Well, it's not. It's the same. It's the same lot every time. The same people. So it's not. But in the street, it's amazing. It's really, people are lovely. Mm. And I enjoy that. I don't mind admitting it.
Gary Lineker, thank you so much for taking the time.
Pleasure.
Pleasure. If you enjoyed that conversation, please leave us a review or tweet us at @joe_co_UK. Join us next Thursday for an unfiltered conversation with Fern Brady. And in the meantime, why not head over to our YouTube channel for the video version of this podcast? See you next time.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to Quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.